Welcome, everyone. This is John Coleman here today, piggybacking on his very own channel with David Rovix. How are you doing, David?
Hey, doing great, John. Thank you.
So the dynamics of StreamYard were such that it was more fortuitous to use David's channel with all the fancy gizmos. So I really feel like I'm on your couch here, David, or something.
Yeah, definitely.
We got like a banner in the bottom here, and that's it's pretty nice. I like it.
Yeah, the paper version is spiffier.
All I got is this whiteboard sign here. You see that?
Great. Yeah, I saw that. It says David Rovix on the whiteboard. Yeah, with the glint of the sun coming in. Yeah, it's good. That's good. But the modern ethos for broadcasting is having some kind of random background, right? And they're even doing shows on Al Jazeera about the random backgrounds and reading the bookshelves, reading all the titles on people's bookshelves, which is usually what people have behind them, you know.
So David's familiar to viewers of this series, A Conversation With, which is on the Apocalypse to Stacy's channel on BitChute and YouTube. David's been on actually a couple times on this series, and most lately, I believe, with Paula, wasn't it, earlier this year?
Yeah, talking about the Song News Network project that Paula and I have been involved with for years now.
Absolutely. So, David, briefly, can you give us just a background of yourself and your work, and then we can hop in to our main topic for this conversation?
And Paula's watching too.
There you go.
She just messaged us, but not on a comment board, just in a private message that popped up on my screen. But fancy technology, the distraction, the constant distraction. What was the question? Oh yeah. Yeah. I'm a singer songwriter. I live in Portland, Oregon, and been involved with some degree of efforts at rent strike organizing in recent months. And I do a lot of blogging and podcasting and live streaming, especially since the pandemic. I was doing some of that before the pandemic. I just started doing more of it since.
So David, what is a rent strike in general? What is the concept? This is going to be very new to a lot of people in this generation and probably anyone younger than about 60 or 70 years of age. What is a rent strike?
A rent strike is when renters stop paying the rent and in an organized fashion, in one way or another. And that can take all kinds of different forms. Hopefully, if it's going to be successful anyway, it tends to involve a high degree of mutual aid and organization, of whatever kind, generally of a horizontal nature, but where people are networking with each other so that when there is an eviction ultimately happening or attempted eviction happening, that lots of people gather together and through various different potential tactical means prevent that eviction from happening, or if the eviction does happen, people can bring the belongings that were put out onto the street back into the apartment and change the lock and un-evict people. And that's the model that was very prevalent throughout the 1930s to such an extent that they banned evictions in the third biggest city in the country, in Chicago. Back during the last Great Depression, evictions were banned. You're breaking up a little. I don't know what's happening.
Very good. And again, we'll touch on this topic later, but this type. How's it now, David?
My end, I'm closing all the other stuff I should have closed before that I had open on my computer, and hopefully that will solve it. But yeah, it's better now. Yeah.
There you go. Yes, and we will touch on this dynamic of organization and of actual community, not just slapping it up on a sign for our towns, but actual community. This is something that is, I think, very unfamiliar to us. So we're going to talk about the difficulties of getting that that cohesion and so forth, especially in an atomized and deliberately atomized society.
Yeah, that's a huge challenge. Absolutely. I mean, and one just to say, like, the general atmosphere among society, I would say the prevalent atmosphere in most of the time is one of defeatism, you know, whether or not it's really recognized as such. But for most people, the idea of talking about succeeding in a strike of any kind, whether it's a rent strike or any other kind of strike, most people, their attitude in this country anyway, at these times, I would say, you know, the attitude generally, from my experience, tends to be one of like, oh, you're just some kind of utopian anarchist, having a pipe dream. And, you know, yes, it might be nice if society were not organized this way, but this is just how it is. You just got to deal with it, you know. But actually, society can be totally different. And we have the benefit of living in a world that has like almost 200 countries in it or whatever it is. And they're not all the same. And in fact, there's really big differences from one to the next. And there are lots of societies where housing is still actually very affordable. And it doesn't need to be the way it is in the US.
David, on my shelf beneath the plastic, delicious-looking plastic sandwich there, is a book, Famine, by Liam O'Flannery, which is a book from Irish literature in the 20th century, and kind of background reading for today is The Landlord features prominently in the topic. Can we can you highlight for us some significant rent strikes in the past?
Well, actually, speaking of Ireland, the rent strike at the beginning of the 20th century in Roscommon was a fascinating and really powerful example that ended up having a profound impact on colonial rule, on the whole land question, on the law under British colonialism at the time. Really was a massive event that took place over the course of years. It was highly organized. In terms of U.S. History, the Chicago rents, the Chicago rent strikes, and the whole, like, you know, not necessarily it's not necessarily that there has to be an organized rent strikes going on as much as an organized council of unemployed or some other such structure. But back in the 30s, it was the unemployed workers councils. And when a landlord knows that a forced eviction is quite likely going to be faced with thousands of militant unemployed workers who are going to oppose the attempted eviction and are going to then carry the evicted tenants' belongings back into the apartment and have professional locksmiths change the locks anyway. If that's going to happen anyway, then they're going to require thousands of police to attempt to do this eviction, which may just fail anyway. You know, that's the kind of prospect that the landlords in the United States and the big cities in the U.S. were looking at back in the 30s. And that has an impact on their policies, in terms of eviction. And in the case of Chicago, it meant an actual legal banning on evictions procedures. And of course, there are lots of countries where forced evictions are just illegal in the first place, and where even if there are landlords and there are these kinds of like private landlord-tenant relationship without a lot of legal rights for tenants or rent control or anything like that, and of course, in many countries, there are much better laws than we have on those things. But even if they don't have a great rent control laws, they still have a ban on forced evictions in many countries. And this has a profound impact on the whole relationship between landlords and tenants and what landlords have recourse to, you know. And so it forces them to have to communicate and negotiate. And they don't have this kind of absolute power that they, really appear to have in any society where forced evictions are legal. You know, but I think the rent strike that I guess maybe there's so many examples, and I'm not even familiar with most of them. I'm sure I've only heard of them, and don't have exhaustive knowledge on all the different rent strikes. Luckily, there's been so many of them that it's really, you'd have to be quite a scholar to be keeping track of all the ones that have happened, including even just keeping track of all the successful ones. But in your neck of the woods there in the northeast of the country, the rent strike that perhaps was like most interesting both because of the scale of it as well as the sort of romantic ideals behind it too, was the in upstate New York, centered around Rensselaer, when the richest family in the world at the time, the Rensselaer family, who owned very large swathes of upstate New York on both sides of the Hudson River, where their tenants, who were farmers, and of course because of the kinds of land reforms that the the Homestead Acts and various other things that happened as a result of that rent strike, many of us today are unfamiliar even with the concept of tenant farmers or sharecroppers. But tenant farmers and sharecroppers were a very prevalent thing all over the country back then, as of course was slavery. But the tenant farmers of upstate New York rebelled, and they stopped paying the rent in huge numbers. And they, through mutual aid, they prevented evictions from happening for 9 years, and they ultimately won. They got the land, they had to pay for it, but they were no longer tenants, and they were able to buy their land and get out from under this this perpetual, sort of modern, not very modern form of peasantry. Really, it's not modern at all. It was just a continuation of feudalism.
I think someone made a song about that, if I'm not mistaken. I remember hearing such a thing.
I have written at least 24 songs on this on related subjects, including one about that particular rent strike, yes, called Landlord.
So, David, prior to the shutdowns, which we'll talk about, which provide, I suppose, the immediate background to the Portland rent strike, prior to that, maybe taking it from the so-called Great Recession the past 10 years or so up until the beginning of this year, what were the dynamics for renters, for families, and for working class sorts in the position of renting, which is oftentimes the only option available to people?
I think it's been such a jagged evolution over the course of a very long period of time. And as I was just talking with Bill Weinberg, an activist and writer, a journalist in New York City, who was around as a young man in the Tompkins Square Park movement in the Lower East Side, around all the squats and the movement against gentrification there. And I mean, you can trace the timeline back to anywhere that you want to, and it's kind of hard to know where to begin. But in terms of modern times, like in the past 20 years or so, although there was a huge problem with stratification of wealth and poverty and homelessness in the 1990s and before the 1990s, it was like night and day in terms of affordability of housing in the 90s compared to what happened after the great financial collapse of 2008, the banking collapse and the bailout. What happened after that? I lived through it, so I was kind of like not really understanding what was going on or why it was happening until very recently, when I've started to get a handle on what's been going on over the past 12 years. But what's been happening is this massive consolidation of housing and financialization of the housing market and investment in housing as a main form of investment, the most profitable form of investment for capitalists, not only from all around the United States, but from around the world. I mean, many of the capitalists who invest in the U.S. housing market are not even from the United States. There's a lot of Norwegian capitalists. They have trillions of dollars in the Norwegian, that nice social democracy in Norway. They have trillions of dollars in this oil fund, and they use it in all sorts of unethical ways. They may have divested from some really outrageously unethical forms of investment, but they still invest in the U.S. and British housing markets, which is a totally unethical investment, if you ask me. And what's developed is a situation that is, I think, has created a greater degree of inequality in this country than at any time since the age of the robber barons. We have to go way back before the Great Depression to get to a time when there's been this much stratification of wealth, and so much of that has to do with the financialization of the housing market that's taken place over the past 12 years and the consolidation of the market. And I mean, wages have not gone up, real wages have not gone up, but people work more and more jobs. And of course, the rents keep on going up. And here in Portland, this is the most rent burdened city in the country in terms of how much people make relative to how much they pay in rent.
You know, that's interesting because I think we've all felt these dynamics for the past while that you mentioned here, the real wage is not going up, the rent certainly going up, and this sort of thing. And, you know, and in what is increasingly turning into an open air madhouse in 2020 here, I can't imagine, as we turn our attention, my question being the situation for renters right now with the disruption of work and so forth, but just to soliloquize, I can't imagine not how chaotic this must be, this situation now, not having a certain grasp on history and on social dynamics and political dynamics, you know, a lot, it, without having a little bit of knowledge of history and those other things. It must really be something else if you were someone who was just binge watching this, that, and the other for the past 20 years.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, if you can't put this into context, it becomes that much more overwhelming. And even when you are into history and when you are a news junkie, even in normal times, like me or you, just trying to process what's happening right now, without even trying to interpret what's happening, but just to understand the depth of it, you know, and the breadth of, I mean, it's really overwhelming. And if it's overwhelming for people like you and me, I can only imagine how much more difficult it must be for people who have not been obsessed with history and politics for their whole adult lives. You know, it's those people are out there. And this is why I started after the pandemic. My inclination was to start broadcasting 5 days a week and interviewing my friends who have a lot of perspective on different things, but partly just to deal with my own mental health issues and have some connection with other adults, because I have three kids, none of whom are in school, and I don't really talk to adults much other than my wife. So, when I'm on tour, I do, but when I'm not touring, I just thought, okay, well, I can talk to people. But the main reason, other than my own, other than self-therapy, it was to try to share some knowledge with other people out there who are also groping around trying to figure out what's happening. I don't know how many of them are looking at my YouTube channel for answers, but those who are, hopefully there's some there.
Mm-hmm. Now, you can further comment on the psychic stresses of this moment, but also getting back to just the financial dynamic of renters. What are we facing, David, with these obviously work stoppages, something else I'll bring to your attention. It looks very clear to me, at least, that grade school is at least going to be disrupted, which means parents are going to have an obligation to not go off to work if they have to get their kid onto Zoom at whatever o'clock in the morning, right? So there's these stresses on top of the psychic stuff you brought up, mental stuff. So what is the situation of renters right now?
Well, the business press, which, as I mean, Noam Chomsky has commented before, that if you want to really understand what's happening in the country, sometimes you get much better information from the business press than you do from the regular mass propaganda kind of corporate media, because the business press, they have people who really depend on understanding what's happening for their success or lack of success for their investments, so they have less leeway to be dishonest and propagandistic, and they have been raising the alarm for months now, that ever since the first bailout, the first multi-trillion-dollar bailout, that was not enough, it was misdirected, and we need a lot more of it. And they've all been saying that, which is just, quite something, that kind of unanimity. And now what they're all saying is, and the numbers, the estimates differ, but but they're talking about somewhere between 20 to 28 million evictions are going to take place between now and the end of September if the trajectory continues on as it is, if the pandemic unemployment assistance actually expires at the end of this month without being renewed, and other factors, if the suspensions on evictions are not continued, and if there is no rent relief, etc. If things continue as they are, we're looking at tens of millions of evictions, or at least attempted evictions. So that's an extremely dire situation. And under such circumstances, the idea that things are just going to go as the landlords and the police and the politicians might, you know, think they're going to go, just because the law says, you know, okay, now you're going to get evicted, that doesn't mean it's going to really happen. You know, I mean, basically the whole capitalist system is breaking down in front of our eyes. I mean, school in the first place was the reason why we have mandatory universal education, and the reason why that, you know, as many other people watching, you know, hopefully know, that this dates back to the Industrial Revolution. It's not, and that's not a coincidence. And we needed places to put the kids while the parents are working. So, you know, once people were not working on farms anymore, and you know, most, or you know, more and more people were moving to cities and not working on farms, they needed to be able to do something with their children. And this is why mandatory public education or some form of public education happened in all the industrialized countries around the same time. You know, it wasn't just like they all had the good idea at the same time. They had to have something to do with the children. And now that's all fallen apart with so-called home learning, which I think for anybody, you know, younger than high school age, it's a ridiculous prospect, because even for high school, but any, especially younger kids, you know, they need each other. They need community. They need a little, you know, kids, people are tribal animals. We need community. You know, we don't function sitting in a room by ourselves with a screen very well. It causes anxiety, depression, and suicide. You know, this is no way to run a school system. But, you know, of course we have a pandemic, so obviously, you know, people, we got to get creative about these things. But to call it home learning is just a crazy even phrase in the first place. And that can only be used by people who don't understand what elementary school is all about when it's done well in the first place, you know. Mm-hmm. But it's you know, it is a warehousing school. I mean, school can be good. I think school can be very good for a lot, for kids. It can be very good for kids in many different ways. And I'm a big believer in society and in you know, societal structures like schools when they're done well. This idea of, you know, learning on Zoom and the idea of the parents all working from home, I mean, it's preposterous. Even if you can work from home, even if you have the kind of job where you can work from home, the idea of working from home while your children are not in school is child abuse, plain and simple.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's my big fear is, well, my fear is that, that parents, that this is not the fear. The fear, people have recognized how obnoxious the modern schools are. They have a certain, there's a certain popularization of the observation you made, David, of the industrial or the economical uses of schools, basically to warehouse kids for a certain number of years. And that's explicitly the case with American high schools, by the way, after World War II. You could read a book called, The Rise and Fall of the American Teenager by Thomas Hine. He gets into that. But people have this observation, and it's one obviously the past 6 years of my life, I obviously agree with, that the mainstream schools are obnoxious and largely a waste of time and certainly money. But my fear is that everyone is gonna run onto these online platforms and think they're getting the same thing, and they're going to completely lose the real magic of what the schoolroom can be.
Yeah, that is the prospect, right? For so many for so much of the things that are moving online. I mean, there are some, you know, pros and cons to doing things online, and it's not all negative. There's a lot of community to be found out there, especially if you're isolated and quarantined anyway. You know, that's but you have to be in that situation. It only becomes like romantic, all this online stuff, when you're in that kind of situation. Like if you imagine, I don't know, in Z Nation, in that movie, is it the zombie series, or I think it was Z Nation, there's the guy in the Arctic who's got no friends other than his dog, and he's like the last person left, you know, up there running this like sort of radio station, and the fact that he can kind of look through his lens of his radio station and have some kind of contact with other parts of the world where people are alive and fighting the zombies. I mean, that makes it's romantic, but it's only romantic because he's so isolated, you know, but nobody wants to be isolated like that, or they shouldn't want to be, I don't think. And I mean, maybe some people do, and that's fine if it's good for you, if you got that kind of, you know, whatever you got going on that you need to be isolated. And that's good. You know, that's great that it's good for some people, but for most people, it's not a healthy thing. And it's not a good alternative to real human interaction. And it's also really scary and fascistic potentially, depending mm-hmm. on who's running things. It's potentially like, so, I mean, when you consider the way the internet is now, I mean, this is not the internet of 1995, much as I wish it were. This is the internet of Facebook, Google, and Spotify. And, you know, this is the internet that is now totally dominated by corporations. And the idea of getting away from them is sort of creating different structures is, I think, increasingly just a pipe dream. You know, because it's like trying to encourage people to ride bicycles when there's a superhighway that you can ride on for free, except for the advertising. You know, who's going to avoid riding on the superhighway if the only thing that they, you know, have to deal with is the billboards? You know, they're going to take it because the bicycle is a hell of a lot slower. And, you know, it's a lot more work and there's nobody else riding. And, you know, I mean, once you build a superhighway, people are going to use it. And that's going to be true of Google, Spotify, Facebook, and then many other platforms. And they make sure that's the case by doing things in such a way that destroys the rest of the platforms and undermines the ability of all the other platforms to exist, the way Spotify has totally destroyed the music industry. And, you know, and it's a terrifying situation now.
Well, we'll return to the larger possibilities with this pandemic a little bit later, David, but let's get to the real, having set up very well the situation here with rent and so forth. Let's talk about specifically the Portland rent strike. And perhaps you can inform us who are not in Washington. What is PDX?
Oh, PDX. Well, it's in Oregon, right? And it's Portland. It's just the acronym, the three-letter code for the Portland Airport, and it has been for a very long time. Portland has had an airport since I can't remember when, but you know, 80 years or something. There's been some kind of an airport here. So
when you hear the strike called the PDX strike, for the viewers, they're talking about Portland, Oregon.
So totally, and they're just talking about the rent strike in Portland, which is not like it doesn't have a. I mean, there is no such thing, I would say, as PDX rent strike. It's just what people in Portland who are rent striking are can be collected under that name because they're in Portland. But it's not to be inferring that this is an organization or something. It's not, as far as I know. It's just that there is quite a bit of rent strike activity and talk about a rent strike going on here. But really, it should be said that when we're talking about a rent strike in Portland, it's a practice rent strike. It's a play. It's a rehearsal for a rent strike. The real rent strike happens when the suspension on evictions is lifted. You know, it's only when you face eviction that you're really rent striking in the sense that we understand the concept in the U.S. I would say it's people are not actually facing eviction until the end of September, although lots and lots of people who, whether or not they fully realize this fact, they're moving out of their places all over the place, and they either they don't know there's a suspension on evictions, or they know it exists, but they are afraid to go into debt for some reason, or, you know, whatever it is. Or in many cases, they're a roommate with somebody else who they share an apartment, and one of them can afford to pay the rent and the other can't. And so because of peer pressure, the one who can't afford to pay basically is moves out, not necessarily forced to move out, but they move out because their roommates are not comfortable with only some of them paying the rent. I mean, there's been a lot of that going on. But for, you know, one reason, multiple reasons, people are moving out of their apartments, and but other people are staying. And according to the national business press, again, is talking about, I think one out of three people in the U.S. Did not pay either the rent or their mortgage last month. Mm. So the situation is so radically much worse than it ever has been since the last Great Depression. I mean, 2008 is not a relevant comparison at this point. This is way, way beyond anything. I mean, 2008, it took years It took years for the kind of process we're talking about taking a few months took years, and it wasn't as extreme, not nearly as extreme as this.
David, can you define the difference for us between an eviction moratorium and a rent freeze, or can you define those terms in general?
Oh, yeah. An eviction moratorium is like whatever, or a suspension on evictions is whatever whatever you might be paying in rent, whether it's high or low, whether it's just gone up or not. The government has declared that nobody can force you to move or to force you to leave your apartment. That's an eviction moratorium. And it ends whenever the moratorium ends. And then evictions are once again allowed. And of course, in what form they're allowed depends on what kind of laws might or might not exist in your locality. But a rent freeze is when the state, and it has to be, at least in this state, it has to be the state. It's not something that municipalities are even allowed to do because of the way the state law works. Because in 48 out of 50 states in this country got rid of rent control laws on a statewide basis, despite the fact that they were very popular in cities. Groups like APEC, groups like these far right neoliberal groups have since the 80s been buying off state legislatures, very much including our state legislature here in Oregon, and many of the state legislatures are full of millionaire landlords and Democrats and Republicans, but they're full of millionaires and landlords and millionaire landlords. These things tend to go together. And they rule on behalf of the other landlords. And sometimes they rule on behalf of tenants when they have to, or when they feel like society is going to fall apart if they don't do something, or they're facing the prospect of losing the next election. But usually it's not a problem because the Democrats have everything wrapped up and they still got rid of rent control decades ago, and they never reinstated it. And it's only recently that rent control has been even talked about by these landlord senators in Salem as something to even discuss. It's still even many progressives in this country are still deluded enough about the reality of the situation to talk about relaxing development laws as the solution, that we need to build our way out of this problem. And it's just a preposterous idea that we need to turn every city into Los Angeles or Houston or Phoenix in order for housing to be affordable. It's a preposterous idea. It's totally, completely, it's a capitalist it's a sign of capitalist successful brainwashing. There's no need to turn everywhere into Houston or Phoenix. You can do much better than that. You can have Gothenburg or Malmo or Copenhagen or Berlin instead, and much, much more livable cities where the rent is in many cases. I mean, it's not universally, but where you can still find in many cases much, much more affordable housing than what you can find in Portland, Seattle, San Francisco, New York, or any number of other outrageously expensive cities in this country, where we have the streets lined with tents and people living in them.
I'm going to lay something out here, and it'll be relevant to the next question, David, as well as something we'll bring up towards the end. And that's kind of a historical vantage that I see, at least, and I'd like you to comment on it, as the question specifically is, what has been the reception that this strike or preparations for a strike have received? So I'll reiterate that question, but the vista that I see really for the last 150, 200 years is increasingly in the West is people's actual democratic ability and willingness and even consciousness to organize, to push back against social structures, political structures, legal structures. It's been ebbing away. I remember telling somebody this in March when the first lockdown, which is a prison term, by the way, the first lockdown came, I was kind of, not to be taken literally, but I was kind of bummed out there weren't any red revolutions going on in the world. Because 100 years ago, there would have been with this sort of a disruption, the people, it doesn't have to be necessarily communists. It could be any, there was no pushback, no assertion of any type of, we kind of got that, I guess, with Chad or whatever it was, but
there's been, I mean, some in Serbia, I guess. And also, I mean, there's been a lot of pushback from the far, from the right wing and the Fox listeners. Because of course the lockdown that's been happening has been a result of a actual real pandemic. So it's not like a lockdown because they are worried about a uprising and they want to put us all in our homes so we don't rebel, you know. And they were so worried about rebellion after they shut down the economy and locked everybody into their houses that most of the countries that could afford to spent a massive amount of money on actually keeping at least large parts of their population from going hungry, like in the United States, where we did get, and it's been so badly administered and so much corruption involved with the administration of it. But there has been quite a lot of aid that has actually reached large segments of the working class in this country, which is why many people who are actually paying the rent and eating right now, it's because of that aid. And that aid is going to end at some point, probably, if we don't follow like the Scandinavian model, which it seems like we're not going to be following, or even the Canadian model, where they have universal basic income now during the pandemic, $2,000 a month everybody gets in Canada, you know, for paying their expenses during the course, say, whether they're working or not, you know, during the course of the pandemic. You know, we need something like that here, but who knows what's going to happen with that. But I think to the extent that people have cooperated with the lockdown, it's because they believe in the reality of pandemics. You know,
and just to conclude my historical idea of things, it's whether or not it's a physical force revolution, like in the sense of 100 years ago, but just in general, following the trajectory of things, labor unions have largely been defanged. People don't even have much interest in the labor topic any longer. We've been atomized in so many ways. And that's all as a background, if you agree with the background, just overall, to the question I have, which is, how has been the preparation or just the idea of a rent strike been received in your neck of the woods?
Yeah, I think, of course, things are changing so much in terms of how ideas are received. And now it's becoming surprisingly mainstream to talk about rent strikes, to talk about deferring mortgages, to talk about canceling rent, to talk about government involvement with regulating the cost of housing. To talk about defunding the police. Here in Oregon, the legislature is now talking about decriminalizing all drugs. I mean, these are actually, these are radical conversations that have become really mainstream. And whether all these things or any of these things or to whatever degree these things are implemented, the conversation is now mainstream. But what is less mainstream is when you get into the specifics. Like what I find is it's very popular to talk about housing should be affordable, to talk about women should be able to walk the streets safely, and police shouldn't be killing black people for existing. You know, these kinds of things are mainstream popular beliefs, that Black Lives Matter and that women should be believed, and all kinds of things that were a lot more fringe beliefs just a few years ago, perhaps. But where the conversation gets much stickier is when you start talking about actual concrete implementation. Like, so if Black Lives Matter, or if single women trying to raise children on their own from any background matter, you know, to take a couple of examples where so much of the poverty in this country is, you know, single mothers and Black families and the hungry children in this country, who are they? You know, one out of four currently going to bed hungry. And what can be done? You know, the city of Portland is, as was just reported in the mainstream press quite recently, just a few days ago, the average rent in the city of Portland is unaffordable for the average Black family in this country. So, you know, the average two-bedroom apartment would not be affordable for the average Black family on their income in this country. And so if Black lives matter, then housing needs to be affordable for Black families. You know, that's an obvious conclusion, an obvious connection. But once you start making those connections, you know, if you start putting up anything about rent strikes or anything about affordable housing and how that can be implemented or anything about landlords, you will be called a class warrior. And, you know, if you put up physical flyers on the telephone poles around here, they will be taken down really quick. But if you put up stuff about George Floyd, Black Lives Matter, Me Too, et cetera, any kind of issue that is perceived as vague enough or social enough to be popular, then yeah, people can go around with Black Lives Matter bumper stickers and put their lawn, the signs in their lawns, and nobody's going to bother those signs or those bumper stickers. But, you know, you talk about anything practical, you know, what you're going to do about the Black Lives Mattering, you know, then it becomes much more controversial. And it's definitely, you know, the line coming from the actually, you know, from the bourgeoisie, from the land owning, large land owning class, that, you know, they love to pretend they're speaking up for the mom and pop landlords because they know nobody cares about the ones who own hundreds of buildings. But it's these are the landlords that are the main driver of the poverty and the miseration of so much of the population. And, you know, they're all talk, but when it comes to actually anything real, then clearly they are the enemy of society.
And on your channel, David, I've seen a few experiments you've done with a staple gun and so forth around town, and you found that to be the case. The posters don't last long. Is that it?
Yeah, absolutely. That absolutely. And I often do it where I put up a poster that says talks about Portland emergency eviction response and or organizing this eviction response group for people that want to do that. And I think it's a fairly non-threatening idea for most people, and a good idea, most people would say. But if you put up that poster in front of a large apartment complex, it's not that it's taken down necessarily by people who think it's a bad idea. It's taken down because property managers and landlords, you know, call the city and the city responds and comes and takes the stuff down. But other stuff, posters that people put up on telephone poles of a more artistic nature or that are talking about social issues that are less concrete, you know, and more vague, kind of nice ideas about peace and brotherly love and everything else. That stuff can stay up for months. It stays up until the rain has totally worn it down and it falls off under the weight of the decomposition. You know, my posters never have a chance to decompose.
David, on the Portland PDX rent strike, they have an interesting expression there I'd like you to speak to just in terms of language usage. And that is not homeless, but rather houseless. And what might be the thinking behind that use of terminology?
It's I don't think it's that widespread yet, but it's definitely not just limited to Portland. And also the PDX rent strike Facebook page is just, you know, people who are doing this thing. It has, I mean, I'm not related to this Facebook page, just incidentally. You know, it's just PDX is the city. And so if people put up a Facebook page that says PDX rent strike, that doesn't mean it's an organization. It just means it's somebody's rent strike Facebook page on, and they like happen to be in Portland. But yeah, but the term, I think, houseless has become common to use the term because we're, I think, because many people who are living outside were not comfortable with the term homeless because they have somewhere to live. And so it's a home, whether it's a house or a tent, you know, so houseless is more accurate in terms of their position in life, because, you know, a tent may be construed to be a home. It's just not necessarily the home they're looking for. And I think that the term houseless also has just become common to use, because with terminology, sometimes it's important just to switch it up, because the term homeless sort of becomes this kind of term like when people sometimes say homeless people, it's like one word. It's like a class of human, you know, the way that the term gets used in some circles of society. And it starts becoming sort of dehumanized, removed from the reality that these are human beings who have nowhere to live. You know, much the same way I think that we don't use the term when we're talking about history. We are much more commonly using the term enslaved person rather than slave, you know, because when we're talking about the history of slavery, you know, slave, it's like, it became a term that was sort of just another way to dehumanize enslaved people, you know, rather than to talk about this, these are human beings who have been enslaved. So it may seem to be semantical, and really it is semantics, but it's also, you know, there's a reason why semantics, you know, people talk about it, because it, you know, these words become they lose their meaning when they're used too much. And so sometimes it's important, I think, just to use a different word just to remind people of what we're actually talking about.
David, you've brushed up on this a couple of times in your responses, but specifically, what has been the reaction of landlords, and including corporate landlords who seem to be the biggest troublemakers, as well as state agents, state bureaucrats, and so forth, just in the press or in your own interactions, or those you know, with the concept of a rent strike? Has there been any threats, any reception or whatnot?
I mean, until recently, it was just it never talked about, and even rent control was never talked about as a practical thing. And anyone talking about either rent control or rent strikes were marginalized if they were ever mentioned in the press or by this supposedly progressive politicians either. You know, and it's a revolving door between the corporate landlords, the senators in the state legislatures, the city councilors in most cities, and the corporate media. This is just a big revolving door. It's just a big, you know, old boys club, basically, that now lets in a few women. You know, that's how it's been all over the country until recently. And but in the past few months, with the pandemic, things are changing because they have to, or at least all those elements that used to not even want to talk about any of these things, as, you know, rent strikes or rent control as a viable option or any kind of a way forward, they're now talking about it because they're terrified, not because they care, you know. I mean, maybe some of them care about us, but if they cared about us in the first place, then they would never have been bought by the landlord. I mean, like if the senators and the legislators in places like Salem, Oregon, or Albany, New York, if they actually cared, or Hartford, Connecticut, if they actually cared about the population, about the working class, then they never would have allowed rent control to end. They never would have passed all this pro-development legislation. You know, they never would have taken the power away from municipalities to determine things like rent control in their own municipalities, which is, as people may not know, that in 48 out of 50 states, municipalities do not have the right legally to pass any kind of rent control legislation. They do not have the power to do that. They can only beat around the bush and do things like try to do things like pass a moratorium on evictions, or they can defund the police, who are the ones enforcing evictions. They may be able to do things like that. They may be able to, you know, decriminalize the non-payment of rent, or, you know, there's ways they can get around it, but they can't actually control what the landlords charge in rent legally under state law And if they try to do that, they're going to be challenged in the courts and they're going to probably lose, because the states in 48 out of 50 cases in this country, everywhere aside from New York and California, which found other ways to get around the problem of tenants' rights, they all passed legislation that banned rent control on a municipal level and on the statewide level, and they did it specifically because it was popular locally. So these politicians are not progressive in the first place, and they whether they're Democrats or Republicans, they're ruling on behalf of the landlord class, and they've made that very clear for many decades now. And the fact that they're now talking about rent control is not because they've changed their minds on caring about the working class and ruling on behalf, not ruling on behalf of the capitalists, is because they're worried about whether society is going to completely fall apart, whether they can maintain what they call domestic tranquility, which means an atmosphere conducive to business and making money, which riots are not. So if we have if we have people smashing all the windows downtown every night, then that tends to get in the way of business and tends to make them think that maybe if they actually start evicting tens of millions of people, all these people are already smashing up downtown every night might grow in number and make the city even less governable, which I think would be a very appropriate response to any kind of wave of evictions.
Mm. David, before we conclude on some abstract topics about this particular and peculiar situation, can you flesh out for us a term you used in passing, but I think one which is quite interesting, the idea of the mom and pop landlorder, and in particular, how they've been employed by the media and commercials and as a type of puppet to hold up. So as compared to the corporate sort.
Yeah, I wrote an essay recently in Counterpunch called Rich Peasants, Poor Peasants, and Mom and Pop Landlords. And I think the concept of the mom and pop landlord is an important one to explore because it's used so much by the corporate landlords because they don't want to they don't want to defend their own interests because they're millionaires or in some cases billionaires, and nobody is sympathetic with them, and they are raising the rent as much as they possibly can in order to make as much money as they possibly can, just like they are destroying the forests in this state. To bring up another example of what these finance investors do, they run logging companies too, but the logging companies have no interest in long-term sustainability or in existing in 20 years. So what they're doing is what they call liquidating their assets. They're just going around tearing down every privately owned bit of forest land in the state and chipping everything, because they're going to cut down all the forests and then they're going to sell the land as real estate and then try to make money in the real estate market once they've destroyed the forests. This is what the same companies are doing, who are owning so many of the buildings up and down the coast. So they're in so many different ways. They are ruling on behalf of the rich, against the climate, against nature. Capitalism is destroying society and destroying the very planet, in its very structure. This whole financialization of the real estate market, you can see what it's doing to society, to the forests. It's just a complete and utter disaster. It is totally disaster. But they hide, their PR companies hide behind this fig leaf, and their PR companies for all these corporations, they say Black Lives Matter. It's the most outrageous thing to hear millionaires saying Black Lives Matter, because if they actually cared about Black lives, they wouldn't be millionaires. But they would have done something else with their money other than paying their workers low wages and making as much money as they can off of real estate or whatever else they've done to make their million. In most cases, of course, they inherited their money anyway. So, but it's the structure is the problem more than the individual capitalists. I'm not necessarily trying to blame each capitalist for the problem that we're of the state of society. But in any case, their PR firms like to talk about that they care about all these marginalized people in society, which is obvious total garbage that they don't care at all. But this is how, and they, of course, they talk, one of the people in society they care most about is the mom and pop landlords, because then they can get some sympathy from the people who are like my sister who has a, lives in a place where there's three apartments, her apartment, my mother, and then the renter. This is the kind of landlord, if you can call her a mom and pop landlord if you want to, that would be an appropriate term according to the way they like to use this terminology. But this is not and people like that can have a very real problem. I'm a mom and pop landlord. Actually, I should mention myself. I have a house that I've never lived in, but my mother is still alive and well, but she's passed on her house to me in the countryside in Connecticut. And without getting into the details, the nice fellow who lives there also can't afford the rent, because like most of the rest of society, he's as low as the rent is, he can't afford it. This is the way it is. But people have to find ways of coping with this situation, and certainly lots of mom and pop landlords are going to be losing their properties as well. But we have to understand that is not that's the corporate landlords to talk about. The mom and pop landlords don't have the interests of the mom and pop landlords in mind. And there's all sorts of ways that we could, as a society, as a government, could financially find ways to deal with this situation to allow the mom and pop landlords not to lose their properties. But I think we should also mention that that anybody who buys houses, and especially when we talk about these mom and pop landlords in the press, you often find, halfway down the article, you realize, oh, this is not just that they're renting one house. These people own five or six houses, okay, I guess they still qualify as mom and pop landlords according to like IRS type of calculations. I mean, under this pandemic loan program, anybody with fewer than 500 employees is considered to be a small business. I don't know any small businesses that have 500 employees. It's not a small business. But these people that own five or six houses, you can call them a mom and pop landlord. I would call them a capitalist. This is capitalism. When you buy a bunch of properties and you hire a management company to manage it for you, and you stay home and you don't work because you have a management company that has taken your inheritance, which is most of the time you're talking about an inheritance. You inherited money from your parents. It was enough money that you did the smart thing and invested it in the real estate market because that is the most profitable place to invest. You decided you're going to farm humans for a living. You're going to make money off of the need for human beings to have housing. You're going to treat housing as a right, not a privilege. And you're going to get people to rent in your houses. And if they can't afford to pay the rent, you're going to get the cops to evict them. If that's your business model, screw you. You have no right to do that. You should have your houses taken away from you, and you can live in one of them. That'd be a fine solution as far as I'm concerned. I have no sympathy for these so-called mom and pop landlords, unless we're talking about somebody who is actually more like a group house situation where you have a triplex and you rent out one of the apartments. I mean, that's a different kind. There are levels here, when you're talking about somebody who owns five or six houses, they made an investment. They made an investment that for many people over the course of the past decades has been incredibly profitable. They made an investment that might have been a good enough investment to send their kids to a private college. And then they can complain, oh, we can barely afford to send our kids to Harvard. We're having such a struggle. We don't qualify for scholarships. We have to pay full tuition because we're just not quite poor enough to require a scholarship. But we only make a few hundred thousand dollars a year. And wow, paying this $40,000 for our kid to go to Harvard. Oh, now we have three kids. They all go on to Harvard. And they're like, whoa, we spend $120,000 a year on their tuition. Poor us. Fuck them.
David, as we come to the end here, I do have one abstract question as we look at these shutdowns continuing. Round two is in the offing, it looks like, in different parts of the country and indeed parts of the world. Where do you perceive that there are other agendas making hay while the sun shines with these social disruptions? And if you do, what do you perceive specifically? And in particular, do you detect a real move to get people onto a social credit score, a digital person merged with a legal person, and this type of thinking that we associate with the term technocracy?
I think, it's a really scary precipice we're on in so many different ways, and there's so many different ways that things could go. It could go in that total, like, lockdown autocratic technocracy kind of thing, where everybody has every move is even more controlled and monitored than it was a few months ago, and which is hard to accomplish. I mean, we were very controlled and monitored a few months ago, and, of course, there's some pros and cons to everybody carrying around a video camera. It certainly has been able to expose police brutality a lot. And, it's not all negative. But in so many ways, I think we can go in one direction or another. And it's hard to imagine just muddling along and continuing the way we were going. I think things are going to be changing in one direction or another. We're either going to have things are either going to move in a much more progressive direction or a much more fascistic direction. And I don't think there are other options that are realistic at this point.
Yeah, I don't think it's fair to say this is, in the sense, what we're at now is like a end of the Roman Empire, beginning of the medieval, in terms of gravity. But I don't think it's off key to say this is something like the 16th century in terms of the shift from the medieval to the modern world. Only it's going to happen much, much faster.
That's interesting. I must admit that my historical knowledge is mostly limited to the 19th and 20th centuries, and I'd be very interested in knowing about this comparison you're talking about, because I'm often thinking about the 1840s, which I think is a really relevant period to what we're going through now in so many ways, particularly the 1840s in Europe. Mm-hmm. But that's probably because I've read a lot about the 19th century, and I think a lot about the 1930s as well, which in many ways in the 1920s in Italy, and which I think is very relevant as well. But then again, also that's, I think, probably largely because that's the history I've read much about. But I hear people mentioning the English Civil War, and I know nothing about the English Civil War, but it sounds like apparently that's really relevant to the current period too. I have no idea why. But why? What happened in the 1600s? Can we turn the tables here and you answer the question? What was going on then?
I'm on your digital couch, so I
must. Yeah, good.
The idea, so the parallel that I was making is, in the abstract, that I'll give you specifics. Abstractly, is you have certain social structures, both in the 16th century and now, which appear to me that people are in them, but they no longer believe them, or they don't believe them as they were initiated. So, for example, you had the feudal system, which came about with the demise of the Roman Empire for a very good reason. And that's because of Vikings and banditry and so forth. So you had to cleave on to the nearest strongman. And over the years and centuries, it developed and had its own problems, of course, but by the 16th century, there's no need. There's no need at all socially for the situation in the 8th and 9th centuries, which led to feudalism to develop, right? But there you were. You still had, with the 19th century, you still had people running around as lords and earls and dukes in the 19th century.
Interesting.
But by the 16th century, you have social systems which have outlived their usefulness, but they're still there. And to make a modern parallel, I believe that's the case with the Western democracies in a large way, that the people who are in these positions no longer actually believe in the principles of the Enlightenment, for instance, of individual liberty and rights. And if you try to talk back to some of these cops about your rights on the side of the road, you'll soon as be tased as anything.
You'll find out what your rights are.
Yeah. So we have this with education, of course, too. You have these, these starry-eyed guys like Horace Mann in the 19th century, education for everyone and broad expanses of knowledge and things. But you can't tell me if you walk into a school down the road that, you know, they believe anything of the initial fire that got the movement. I'm also aware of the industrial aspect, which you brought up, too. I'm not gainsaying that. But, you know, at least in the best possible light, in the most idealistic sorts, that is not alive any longer, except in statuary and posters on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
And so I see just a lot of social institutions which have they have many people involved in them, but their actual adherents are the true believers within those institutions aren't there any longer. So they have to snap, just like institutions like the massive Catholic Church or other institutions coming up, like the state was in the 16th century, right, to compete with the church, right. Mm-hmm. So you have other things rising, which is my, I guess the parallel here would be just as you had the nation state rising in the 16th century, the analog to that I would see as being like this whole digital world, which seems to be coming into perception for me, at least as I follow things. One word you used in your one of the analogies you mentioned about logging companies just trying to sell off the product.
Yeah.
Do you, I don't recall specifically the expression you used. Do you? I don't need it, but it would be helpful.
Liquidating assets.
Yes. That almost seems to me like what's happening now in a lot of ways. For instance, a lot of the churches here have shut down. Right. I think schools will also do this. A lot of colleges and things that they're going to both communities institutionally were, you know, they were kind of living on the fumes of previous generations.
Yeah.
And I think now they're just going to literally go bankrupt and write everything off with reinsurance, you know, insurance, and you have reinsurance behind that.
Mm.
Right. So I see a lot of these seemingly megalithic things such as institutional education or the state or the church, that they're massive socially. You go everywhere you want to go, David, you'll see schools everywhere. But because the spirit is no longer in these, whatever got those things going, that something else must replace them. You can't just keep this zombie going like Weekend at Bernie's or whatever forever, you know, just carrying on the corpse. Did I answer your question?
Yeah, that's interesting. And yeah, certainly a lot of the universities are already closing and were closing before the pandemic hit. And here in Oregon, I mean, in Portland, we've lost like two or three just in the past like couple of years. You know, the private colleges can't afford to function. And the ones that can function, as far as I understand it, the reason why, and I believe the only reason why many of them are really still functioning, is because they are tapping basically the global bourgeoisie for their student base.
Yeah. Because everyone here is tapped out. People are, you know, they've overplayed their hand here. All the middle class are up to their head with student debt. And that's even since 2008, the enrollment into colleges has been going down. So yeah. That's an excellent observation you made.
And it's easy to see, like, where, I mean, of course, you go to Harvard or MIT, and what is it? I think one out of three students are from East Asia. And there are people who were some of the top in their class in China and other countries, and their parents are spending their entire life savings and spending full tuition at Harvard in many cases. And that's a lot of students that they are relying on from other countries to pay private tuition, which would, and the universities, I think, wouldn't be able to function if they were only accepting. There's not enough Americans whose families make enough money to pay full tuition at Harvard to populate that school full of qualified students.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting times. That's for sure and certain. And if another round of closures, a real systematic round comes, which it seems to be the case, at least what I'm following here, it, you know, if your business wasn't bankrupt before, and if you weren't bankrupt before, you will be now.
That's right. And they say, I think the Restaurant Association of the U.S. is predicting that 85% of restaurants across the country will be closing permanently by the time the pandemic is over.
Yeah. Do you, as I pick your brain here, David, and I won't belabor because you got to get on with your day and this and that, but do you perceive, actually two things. Do you perceive that the state wants there to be unrest, social unrest for its ends, for greater control? And then also that you bring up restaurants, has your reading brought up the reality of food shortages?
Yeah, I mean, we're already in a situation because not because of food shortage, but because of stratification of wealth and the total broken nature of the employment departments in so many states, and the fact that they don't cover so many of the unemployed workers, including, of course, undocumented workers, and, you know, so many different reasons. Here in Oregon, I mean, I've been trying to get unemployment for 3 months and never get anything but a busy signal. So it's just, this is the situation for most of the gig workers in this state, which is 100,000 unemployed people last count. But yeah, it's there is already hunger already. I think according to some mainstream press sources, we're talking about 1 in 4 kids going to bed hungry in this country right now. Mm-hmm. But so I think definitely there are different elements of people in power or not in power who can see the usefulness of instability in society to further their aims, whatever their aims might be. But that can be true of people like me who want to see a more egalitarian society, a much more egalitarian society. And it can be true for people like Trump, who are clearly looking for an opportunity to institute full-blown fascism in this country. So in either case, lots of instability can be potentially advantageous. I think it is equally true that if there are riots every night in downtown Portland, that's going to give the governor and the mayor some second thoughts about lifting the suspension on evictions, for example. It's going to encourage them to consider the demands that people are making to defund the police, for example, you know. But at the same time, the riots going on every night in Portland. I'm not saying there are riots going on every night. I'm just saying that in the popular perception, that's what's happening, right? In the media, certainly that's what's going on. And if that's going on every night, then that's certainly also, as we can see in recent statements Trump has made on national TV, you know, this is a good excuse for him to call in more federal troops and to declare ultimately, you know, the kind of fascism he's looking for. It's not enough. I mean, he needs a lot more instability in order to get some more sympathy for his authoritarian fantasies. But either way, instability can feed, can feed things in either direction. I mean, there are those in power who don't want instability because they liked how things were, and there's those in power who maybe they liked how things were, but they'd like things to be more unequal, and so instability is going to help them further their aims for further inequality or more technocracy or more autocracy or whatever. You know, there's lots of advantages potentially that they can, where they can take advantage of instability, and then it can also work the other way, where it can inspire, things like the New Deal, which was also directly inspired by mass instability in society.
So, David, where can we find out about your work and your website, your shows, and even in that happy day, your shows in real life as well? Where do you have websites and this sort of thing?
Oh, yeah, davidrovics.com, and all my music is up on all the streaming platforms, and I broadcast every day, most weekdays at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern. I've been broadcasting interviews with people as well as an open mic every Monday, and I have no shows for actual physical audiences, because even if it were advisable, to do such things, even if they are going to be opening up venues at 25% capacity or whatever it is, which hasn't even happened here yet. Mm-hmm. But even if that were to happen, venues can't survive on 25% capacity unless they're being massively subsidized by the state, and neither can performers. Mm-hmm. And the music industry, it's worth noting, was in a total state of collapse before the pandemic. And that really started with the rise of the internet, but it really increased really dramatically when Spotify became a free platform. It cannot be overemphasized what degree Spotify has single corporately defeated the global music industry that used to exist at both the commercial and the indie music industry, in one fell swoop. It is the industry was in a state of collapse. So the idea that we could even survive on venues that are less than 100% full is a fantasy, because we already lost half our income when CDs stopped existing. And we already, most of us artists living in places like Portland, have already seen our rents double and triple since the time that CDs stopped being a thing, right? So, just try to imagine why or how anybody is still doing music for a living. If they are, it's because they're really, really famous, or because they're totally subsisting on patronage like me. But otherwise, people have gone and looked for other work. And you can see that in the IRS and the, census statistics. Between one census from 2000 to 2010, there's 41% fewer people who claim to be musicians, in the professional sense. Not that there's fewer people playing music. There's more people playing music than ever, I think, and that's great. But in terms of anybody making a living at it, it's really dismal. And it was before the pandemic. I can't imagine how anything is going to happen in terms of touring unless it's a tour of Canada or something that's got government subsidies, or it's, after there's a vaccine that's been passed out around the world.
Yeah, people, David used the term liquidating. It's not just liquidating capital assets. It's also liquidating culture. I really see that the powers that be are they want everyone else to be, they want the whole world just to be on their, what do they call it for children? What do they call this for children, David? You have three of them. What do you call the toy that you give the children, a play
device,
like a leapfrog for everyone.
That's it. Okay. Yeah. I don't have that. I'm behind the times. I don't know what a leapfrog is.
Leapfrog is like, I don't know. It's one of those
gaming devices, right? I only just learned what a Switch is. And I want to get one because I want to play Animal Crossing because everybody else is doing it. So I'm not a technophobe. I mean, I'm scared of the technocracy, but I embrace the new technologies and I try to use them like you do, to try to communicate with people for better or for worse,
Yeah, absolutely. But these changes, in any case, are going just to hollow out culture, hollow out music until all we have is Spotify and elevator music and whatever.
And that's been going on for over a century. Yeah.
Bingo. Well, I'm John Coleman, everyone. I have on, coming up on the 22nd and 23rd, I have two free webinars concerning the future of education, something which David and I talked a little bit about here. And those evenings are 7 p.m. each night, Eastern Standard Time. The 22nd is for students in college, even grade school, parents, the general public. And then the 23rd are for professional teachers, student teachers, administrators, and people who make a living off of teaching. So the topic is the same, the future of education. The audiences are different on the two evenings. And if you're interested in that, please email me at abacusdestacesinstitute@aol.com. And then I will send you the talking points so that you know what we're going to go over that evening. It'll be a private conversation, in a group. And then also you need to email me so that you can get the link to get on the webinar. So with that, David, thank you so much for your time. And I hope to chat with you down the line.
Absolutely. Take care. See you again.
Thank you, David.